Oh, it's a pig!
Welcome to the Lake Erie Kayak Anglers Podcast, the podcast designed to make you a better angler. I'm Chuck Earls with LakeErieKayakFishing.com, and today we have Jeff Little joining us again. Jeff was on for episode 5 to talk about who Jeff is and Torquedo. So definitely go back and check out that episode. But today's a little bit different. Today I want to talk about your YouTube channel that you have, Jeff, and all the awesome resources that you have for the anglers out there.
Cool. Thanks for having me on, man.
Absolutely.
You know, you've been featured in a bunch of different episodes. We did the series of 3 Lake Erie kayak fishing where we went as far as, 7 miles offshore?
Yep.
And
we were actually out of Lorraine, off of the dump.
That's sort of the kind of content I like to produce that really teaches folks something new. And I think that one was a tremendous primer for a lot of people that want to get out and employ some trolling tactics. I know we did a little bit of, crankbait grinding the bottom, a little bit of jigging, but mostly it shows what can be done covering a ton of water in trolling and catching those Lake Erie walleye. So walleye is one of the playlists on there. Do you mind if I just pull up the
let's bring it
channel
up.
And we kind of dig through what's on there. I'm gonna hit this share screen thing there and I'll hit share. So this is, you know, YouTube as a platform is something that you really have to curate a channel in a way that you put your content out there in a way that YouTube wants you to do it. But I really encourage folks to dig around in my channel. Like if you just went through the videos and looked at what was there. And this is a whole lot of winter bass fishing stuff that I've been doing here recently. And maybe that's not as interesting to you as if we went in and clicked on playlist. Playlist unlocks the 744 different videos that I have there. As we scroll down there, I have content with John Boats, water trailblazing. That's something on getting into water that no one else has been to, because we go in with kayaks and chainsaws and open up, you know, trees that fell across a river and you're getting to places that no one else has been. Gear maintenance, conservation, inflatable kayaks, tidal largemouth. I live in Maryland and we have a lot of really great largemouth fisheries that have tidal influence. Obviously a ton of Torquedo content, specific, you know, install videos, product features, health and fitness shorts, speckled trout. So I do get to get down into the Gulf Coast in Florida, do some speckled trout fishing. There's a redfish one, but here's the walleye. And I'm hoping to add to this one with you. And this was the first one we did together. And we were not in kayaks for this one. And it's a fun, for sure, a fun video that shows what the Torquedo travel motor does. But you know, your viewers that know who you are and like your content, if they haven't watched any of my content, please, you know, watch these, because they really showcase, you know, your knowledge, Chuck, and really show, you know, can really be a big kickstart to somebody, you know, kayak fishing for walleye out of the, in that area. So,
right. Yeah. And I think it does a good job showcasing your skills as well. And your unique approach to it. One of my favorite playlists that I found really is your Tackle Craft playlist. The way that you take you know, ordinary presentations and lures, and you you do certain things to them to modify them and change the way that they act and the way that the fish view them. I just find that very intriguing. You know, that's thinking outside of the box, you know, because the little stuff produces big results.
Yep. It's the tackle craft is all about all the little details that I feel are important to a very specific part of, you know, of fishing. What's tied on at the end of the line. And this one, for instance, is about making a spinnerbait with two R-bend wires such that you can throw it into brush. And it has sort of a V formation, and it goes in and comes out clean. And we're not going to watch ads in this podcast, but that's honestly, that's what keeps me in, you know, in video cameras and hard drives and SD cards and everything else are those ads. But this, you know, the twin spin spinnerbait is something that I've made because I didn't see something, you know, off the shelf or out in the market that did exactly what I wanted to do. So I made it. This one was just how I modify the Z-Man jackhammer, in tying my own skirt colors on there. The favorite finesse jig is something I've just been doing a lot of here recently, and even modifying different do it molds to make a head shape with a bristle guard the way I want it. This is another one that's not really tackle crafting as much as modifying an existing bait by putting a skirt on the belly hook. Just did that recently.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. You know, and maybe it caught my eye because I recognized that bait. That's the same bait that you caught that Lake Erie smallmouth on.
And it was a deeper diver version of that. But it was that live target crayfish crankbait that unfortunately they discontinued, but I'm embarrassed to say how much I bought of those, but I still have a pile of them.
Lifetime supply.
No, I'm but a lot.
So what got you into tackle craft, Jeff?
So there's a funny story attached to that. There's a couple stories that kind of string together. When I'm a parent, I got two boys, and I think the key to being a good parent is to help your kid find their fishing or their whatever it is that they wake up in the morning and can think of nothing else. And my mom was good for that. When I was a little guy, the Easter Bunny didn't bring me you know, Cadbury eggs and jelly beans in the basket. I got topwater poppers and MEP spinners and all kinds of stuff. And one of them was a Bagley's Poppin B3, and it was a unique shape popper that had a propeller on the tail, but it had an interesting cut out of the abdomen of that belly that was all red, and it looked like a bird had been chewing on it and may have dropped it. And it was such a great go-to lure for me growing up fishing, you know, neighborhood ponds and some farm ponds here in Maryland that, you know, I had as a 11-year-old and a 14-year-old and even as a young 20-something had gone swimming when bank fishing and snagged it, you know, on a bush out in the water in like early and mid March, right? Like I didn't care. I was always getting that back. So fast forward to me being a, you know, maybe a year after graduating from the University of Maryland, I'm on a week long camping float trip with my buddy Rob on the Upper Potomac. We covered 67 miles in about 6 days. Camping along the way, it was the first, you know, really, you know, week-long camping float trip I'd done out of kayaks. I'd done them out of canoes and Boy Scouts, and you know, that was a normal thing to take a take a week and go out into the wilderness for a week. But this was the first time doing it in kayaks. And I brought, you only have so much room and you want to bring enough of your camping gear and food and water just to make sure that you get, you know, you can do what you need to do. But I had one tackle box with, you know, a small assortment of plugs. And, you know, my buddy Rob and I, he was my college roommate, and we would pass it back and forth like, oh, I want to try this or try that. And we just, you know, we would float and paddle and catch fish and, you know, keep a couple for dinner and just enjoy ourselves. And at some point, Rob looks at me with a different kind of expression on his face, like, hey man, can you hand me the tackle box? And I turned around immediately. I'm like, no, Rob, you had it last. Where the is it? And he tells me after the fact, he's like, at that point I had to think through, okay, which of us has the gun in their kayak? Because we did bring, you know, firearms, but, you know, and he was like, I knew I was safe because I had the gun in my kayak, but he knew he had lost that tackle box. And in that tackle box was that Bagley's Poppin' B3 that I'd had forever, that mom had, you know, as the Easter bunny, had put in my Easter basket when I was probably 9 years old. And I was, you know, after I was done being mad at Rob and we had to go to the next campsite and walk around and ask for, you know, ask random people, hey, you have any fishing tackle? Like, we just need a couple hooks to catch dinner, catch a couple catfish to eat. You know, after I was done being mad at him, you know, we finished that trip, which has a lot of other fun stories. Like my hypothermia story is my near-death hypothermia story is from that trip as well. Anyhow, you know, I got home and I'm like, I'm still sad that I don't have this thing. Let me see if I can order them. They were discontinued, just like at Live Target Crayfish Crankbait. And, you know, I said, I got to have them. Like, how do I, you know, locate them? And I just couldn't. And I said, you know what, let me thumb through this Jan's Netcraft catalog. And I did that and found the basswood and the little screws and in the scale pattern to like put your, the, you know, to airbrush paint. I never did the airbrush. I always just use regular, you know, acrylic paint and whatever. I made my own. I made my own Poppin' B3. And that was the early days of internet message forums. And one of them was called bronzeback.com. And out of that grew riversmallies.com. And one of the people that was on there was Al Agnew. I'm going to turn, if you don't know who Al Agnew is, look at some very old Bass Pro Shop artwork on the cover of the Bass Pro Shop catalog. Al Agnew is an amazing artist. He did this, right? So that's a smallmouth from somewhere in the Ozarks. No, I'm not really, because I'm sharing it. I gotta stop sharing to show you the artwork. Anyways, I was making these topwater poppers, and I traded them through riversmallies.com with the man that did that smallmouth. Can you see it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful.
Yeah. Thing. So, you know, I'm doing my own sort of functional artwork and making lures because I'm trying to replicate something I can't purchase anymore. That's how it started. But I, you know, through riversmallies.com, I ended up trading, not knowing who it was because he had a different handle other than Al Agnew. But when there was a lure swap, and I have two plugs that Al Agnew made. I don't know. It was a big deal to me, but that's how I got started with tackle crafting is carving my own plugs out of basswood. From there, it kind of transitioned to anytime I thought, you know, hey, this is a bait that I've purchased, but I can do better. And whether that media has been pouring lead, shaping spinnerbait wires, initially pouring and then eventually injection molding soft plastics, tying jigs, whatever it's been. I've enjoyed being able to make my own stuff. And I think over the years, I've probably paid more in supplies than actual fishing lures. I mean, I'm looking around just in my office because it's kind of everywhere. There's a twin spin spinnerbait that's halfway done. Here's a bag of spinnerbait swivels. Here's an entire bag that I'm taking with me to tie more finesse jigs. It's going with me on this trip. It's got a bobbin, it's got flyhead cement, it's got the skirt material, it's got finished jig heads that I've poured and shaped and painted and have bristle guards on. It's got the skirt material there, it's got round rubber, whatever. I'm always working with my hands to make stuff that I'll use that's effective, has a good hookup percentage, gets bit, but it's, I don't know, it's a productive use of my energy, my creative energy, that I enjoy doing it. I get a lot of stuff from Barlow's Tackle down in Texas, from Lure Parts Online. Do It Molds, I actually pro staffed for them for a number of years and produced a bunch of videos for them, and it's just fun making stuff. And I do the videos in the Tackle Craft playlist as a means to try to invite other people to get creative and to say, you know, let me show you, it's not that hard, but you got to have the courage just to jump in and try making something. Do you make any of your own stuff, even worm harnesses or anything like that?
I make a couple of worm harnesses, but that's pretty much it at this point.
Okay.
I did buy Julia an airbrush set a couple of years back just to kind of keep promoting her love for painting, but I've never tried to paint my own lures yet.
Right.
But I want to get into it, you know, and it kind of comes from the day that I came out last spring. And we walked into your horse barn, you know, and I actually seen firsthand all the different things that you had for producing tackle. And I was infatuated. And then, you know, I just started kind of digging into the other videos and stuff that you made. And I don't know, man. I think it comes down to it allows you to focus more on the presentation that you're giving the fish and understand a lot more and experiment, you know, just because, well, like the that plug, for example, that you tied the skirt on. I mean, you could have tied the skirt on and it didn't do what it was supposed to do, or it didn't, you know, produce fish, but then, you know, but, you know, by doing so, now you have something that really mimics a crayfish, a crawdad, under the water.
Yep.
And I mean, that's going to produce the biggest fish, the fish that have seen everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It does make something a little bit different. And there's a lot of products out there that are designed to like spike it, just dip in the tail. I mean, those are little things that anyone can do very easily. But I will tell you that the biggest thing that tackle crafting gives you is faith. If you had an idea and then you made something based on that idea and you put it out there and you've put effort, so you're all in, you think this is it. And, you know, I have a video that I produced recently. It's called, I think the thumbnail just says going mental. And it talks about the psychological part of winter kayak fishing. And part of that is having faith in where you just placed your lure, or in your case, where you chose to explore. You went there for a reason. You had an idea. You believe that there's fish there, or else you wouldn't have gone there. You believe there's fish there, or else you wouldn't have made a cast in that direction. But your faith in where you put it reaches another level when you're using something that you made. It's I don't know. It just, when you have that faith, it gives you the focus to really have a good presentation. And I think it makes a bigger deal if it's a, you know, if it's something like a jig where you have to really be paying attention to when they go pop and you feel that, that hit, you have to be laser focused on that to know to time the hook set right. In that laser focus, you develop that with faith, with believing in what you're doing. And I think it's analogous for so many different things in life, but it's definitely the case with fishing. If you have faith in what you're doing, you're going to have the focus to do it well. And tackle crafting for me does that. And I've taken it to the nth degree in terms of, you know, like all this, all the equipment that you saw in our barn was, it's years of my own tackle crafting and tinkering and coming up with stuff, but it was also, my half of confidencebaits.com is I started a custom lure, company with a buddy who also liked to pour his own jig heads, and we came up with some really cool stuff. But Confidence Baits is a business that I started with a friend, and we had some coverage in Bassmaster magazine years ago. And in, you know, I think the lead pot that I have has poured probably more weight in lead than the F-150 that I drive right now. Like so much lead has gone through that pot in producing dragon heads and other, you know, spinner baits and buzz baits and jigs and everything. I did it commercially for a number of years, and we, you know, we parted ways as partners, and Roy still runs Confidence Baits. And we parted on great terms, but I didn't have time to, you know, to sit in my garage for, you know, 4 to 8 hours every night after work and pour lead and shoot plastic. I just didn't, you know, it made some extra money, which was good. And it helped my family for sure. But like, you know, you do it for the love of it. And right. I had other things that I love doing. So I, you know, I said, Roy, I'm out. Good luck. I'll continue to help you however I can marketing, but I got to get out of it.
You know, one thing that you said is it increases your confidence. And when you were saying that, I was thinking about it. When you're trying a new bait, there's a lot of thoughts that are going through your head. You know, how long have I had it on there? Am I using the right color? Is maybe this one's not running like the rest of it. So, you know, the fish aren't going to bite that. And you're quick to, or at least I'm quick to switch it up sometimes. And I always switch it up to something I've caught a lot of fish on, just a confidence bait. Well, when you produce your own baits, I think you naturally have that confidence where you're like, I made it. So I'm just going to give it a little bit more time. You know, and maybe that's what it takes. Maybe that's the couple seconds more that it takes, you know, for that fish to pick that thing up or initiate the strike.
So experimentation with different, you know, different depths, different speeds, different profiles, different vibrations, different, you know, whatever it is healthy to a certain point. And it's healthier for certainly for your more, I don't want to say more novice anglers, but if you don't have a whole lot of experience in a particular fishery, for instance, or just fishing in general compared to others, you know, it's healthy to experiment up to a point. And at some point you do need to come back to something, you know, that you say, I know that this bait works and maybe I need to change how I'm fishing this bait as opposed to changing this bait to another bait. Right. You know, if you know that this is going to work, you know, maybe it's not the bait's fault. It's your fault because you're not, you don't have it deep enough. You don't have it fast enough, or it's too fast. And experimenting with the presentation as opposed to what the bait is almost always a faster way to dial in on what are they going to eat today.
Interesting. So what's your favorite part about doing all this, Jeff? The tackle craft and mainly the YouTube channel, you know, putting out content, because I'm a content creator myself. I mean, I don't put out nearly as much content as you do, but it's a lot of work. I know you're over there spending 12, 13, 15 hours a day pumping this stuff out. So like you said, it's always a labor of love, the reason we do this stuff.
It is.
So I kind of want to know just...
I will tell you this much. I just pulled... Can you see what I got?
River levels.
I can't read it. But this is an old... it's an old record book that I, you know, the old style composition notebook. But what's in there are river gauges and what I caught on specific days, right? And on some of these, I have fairly detailed, you're never going to read that, but it records, all right, at we did a float on 3/12, March 12th, 2005. And this is on the Rappahannock. Went from hole in the wall, which is an access, just the locals call hole in the wall, to the roadside pull off. Caught 6 fish, 14 incher, 17 and a half, 17 and three quarter, 18, 18 and a quarter, and a 19 incher. The water temperature went from 42 degrees up to 47 degrees. The turbidity, the water clarity was between 2.5 and 3 foot of visibility. It had been, and I have the gauge in terms of it started at 3.17 feet at the Fredericksburg gauge and went down to 3.10. So it's a slow drop in the river level. It's slowly, you know, clearing out. And then I have pattern information. The pattern was soft wash on a steep mud bank, deeper water. Three of them were behind a big mid-river rock formation in the center of the eddy. I also had 3 breakoffs. That's interesting. One behind a wood eddy in wood with a steep mud or clay bank. Details.
Right.
Okay. This is how I did it. 2005. My videos are a much more evolved version of that. And I'm not saying I still don't go back to that occasionally. I absolutely do. Especially if I'm like, I'm going to this little creek that's a tributary of the such and such river. And I need to know before I make the 2.5 hour drive south into Virginia that if I check the gauge now and it's saying it's 4.6 feet, what is that relative to what I did back in 2003? That information's in there. That's great. But I didn't keep doing things that way. The logbook, so to speak, has transitioned it's transitioned to video where I chronicle, okay, for mid-March on the Rappahannock, what's a good pattern? What am I going to go look for? What's the presentation? Where's the location they're going to be? I've made a video for everything in the last, since 2009, roughly, on all sorts of different patterns, all sorts of different fisheries. Why do I do that? Is it so that I can be independently wealthy from all of the income that I have from YouTube? I'm sorry. If you want to be a YouTuber and produce fishing content and make a living at it, You either need to be female and be smoking hot, or you just need to come to grips with that, that being a YouTuber in the fishing industry for almost everyone else is a very expensive hobby, not a way to make a living. And, right. and I'm working hard at it because I make a living through selling Torquedo motors. I do. And there's product placement in there because it's such a critical part of what I do.
But it's an awesome product too.
So if the motivation is that, hey, I'm going to, and I would say 4-ish years ago, if you were in this situation in when YouTube was paying better, it would have been a different story I'm telling. It's not for the money. I struggle to clear $100 a month. And if you look at how much content I produce, you'd be like, yeah, you'd be nuts to continue to do that. I am going to continue to do that. Do you know why? Because I love doing it. It is a really expensive hobby, not a vocation. And I've done it naturally over years because it is a way for me to relive the adventure, teach others, which I enjoy. I guided for 10 years. I was a kayak fishing guide in Mid-Atlantic rivers for river smallmouth and was American Canoe Association certified paddling instructor. And I enjoy the teaching, right? But I'm always learning new stuff and I'm hungry for more lessons because when you learn something in fishing, you learn something on the water. And I learn people from experts like yourself on specific fisheries. It's awesome to go out with you and then go across the entire United States down to the Gulf of Mexico and do something very similar that I did with you for walleye on Lake Erie. And a week and a half later, I'm doing it and hooking into a tarpon in Gulf of Mexico. And the thing's going, you know, 8 feet up in the air. And it's like, this is insane. But it was the same trolling speed and a very similar bait that tarpon hit. So getting better at it and internalizing those lessons, that's the motivation for me. And it's enjoyable to relive the adventure by editing it. And also by looking back and looking at some of the videos I did when my boys were very young and look at that video where Sawyer is dead sticking a jerk bait because I told him to stop moving it. And unlike most adults, he actually listened and didn't move it and catches a, you know, 4-pound, 9-ounce, 19 3/4-inch Susquehanna smallmouth. And I get to make a video saying, so the kid can do it. Can you stop moving the jerk bait and let him eat it? You know? But yeah, it's storytelling. I enjoy it and it's teaching, but it's internalizing lessons that I've learned so that they stick with me and I'm better the next time out. So a lot of different rewards in there. A lot of different reasons that keep me producing it. And ultimately, it keeps me having adventures.
Yep. Yeah, because you're always looking for the next lesson, the next opportunity to teach or dial in a fishery.
We will be back after the short break. Storm damage got you down? Don't go through the roof. Call Journey Home Restoration to schedule a free storm damage analysis. If damage is found, they will work with your insurance company to get you a new roof at no cost to you. Give them a call at 440-454-2020. Don't forget to tell them that Chuck Earl sent you.
So you're actually heading my direction again. What, in about a month?
Yeah. Tomorrow I leave here very early. I'm in Maryland and I will drive. At least Google Maps tells me I got a 17-hour drive to Miami. I'm there for what I will tell you is my least favorite part of my Torquedo calendar, which is the Miami International Boat Show. I would love to tell you that I'm going to Miami to slide my kayak into those canals and catch peacock bass and snakehead and clown knife fish. And there's so many other cool things down there that are going on. There's bonefish that you can catch and barracuda and tarpon and everything else. There's so many cool things that you can do in that part of the world, but I'm going down there to set up a booth and work a show that is not very fishing centric. Once I get past that and I run and I, you know, set up that trade show, work it for 5 days, break it down, which takes several days, and have everything shipped back up to Torquedo headquarters in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Once I'm done with that, then I go to South Carolina and I film with Corey Dreyer, who's your fellow Team Torquedo angler. He's someone who's done the kayak fishing tournaments for over 10 years, and I'm going to get a 10-year retrospective on the water interview. I already have my interview questions lined up to pick his brain and to have him kind of talk about, hey, we started with, you know, with whatever measuring device you could find and, you know, a regular point and shoot camera. And at the end of the tournament, you open this up, pull the SD card and said, here you go, tournament director. And he puts it in his computer, uploads it, and nobody knows what anyone's caught, to what we have now where everyone can watch on Tourney X or Fishing Chaos, like who's in the lead and you know, you can watch it real time. To have Corey Dreyer go through that perspective and to kind of talk about the evolution of the sport of bass fishing out of a kayak in a tournament is going to be kind of cool. He's also going to be someone who I'm going to talk a little bit about, that he's one of us who have taken a hobby and turned it into a profession. He sells kayaks for Confluence Outdoor, which is Wilderness Systems and Perception and yes, Pelican, because Pelican bought Wilderness Systems and Confluence. But he's, you know, he's got a full-time job in the industry, and to talk about, you know, hey, that's one way to do it. And there's a lot of people that do this sport that you know, look for different ways, you know, yourself included, to how do we do a full-time, you know, how do we let this become our life in every way possible? And he, you know, he took a pathway similar to mine, which is sales. And there's a lot of different ways, but he's one that has done a little bit of everything. So it's going to be an interesting interview from that standpoint. After that, I get to chase Mike Iaconelli around one of the lakes down there in South Carolina as he pre-fishes for the BASS championship, the kayak fishing championship down there. That'll be interesting getting someone who's done everything else in competitive bass fishing to give a perspective on jumping into the kayak fishing competition and the similarities, differences, and what, you know, what if someone who is from the bass boat world and is interested in jumping into the kayak fishing tournaments, what the differences are, what they need to figure out before they do that, and what it's like to pre-fish in a kayak as opposed to a bass boat, and what he likes more about the kayak scene than he does the bass boat scene. So that'll be an interesting one. And then I'm home, and that's a month. Sometime, I think 8 or 9 days after, I'm coming your way, and we're gonna go to the show, and I'm gonna co-present with you. I'm looking forward to that because it's more education, more teaching people about the sport, about cold water safety, about how not to die when doing this sport, and then to teach other skills, and then after then, well, I'll let you talk about what we think we're gonna do.
Yeah, the Cleveland Boat Show is coming up. We got to get through Columbus first. Columbus is this weekend, which at the time of this podcast, it'll be last weekend. But coming up March 17th through the 20th, we're going to be at the Cleveland Boat Show. We're going to do, well, Jeff and I are doing cold water kayak fishing safety, and then I'll be on the fishing stage talking about all the different species that you can target on the kayak on Lake Erie. So not just walleye, all the other good stuff. And then I'm going to also have a booth set up there, and Jeff will be hanging out in the booth with me, you know, so you guys can stop by and talk fishing with us, talk torpedo with us, talk strategy, you know, just stop by and have fun. Jeff's also going to spend some time in the Paddling Discovery Center, which is actually a cool thing that they've added this year. They have the paddling pool for the presentations, and I think they have some re-entry seminars going on as well. And then they have the Paddling Discovery Center, which is going to basically have kind of a collection of all the different kayaks, designs and stuff like that. And you're actually bringing something to kind of showcase that. When you first sent it to me, I was kind of blown away, because I grew up, my aunt lived on the Grand River, upper Grand River, up by Rock Creek. And, you know, like your videos cutting down the trees, you know, laying across the river. I mean, that's kind of how it was. We'd take the canoe down river and, you know, you'd go as far as you could until you hit the tree that's laying across. And that could be 5 miles. It could be a mile, you know. But I remember that situation. And then when you sent me that inflatable, I thought about our tributaries here in Northeast Ohio and the steelhead and the smallmouth, and the opportunities that this rig presents there. So why don't you tell me a little bit about that? That's the Innovative Sportsman Osprey 1436.
Yep. And I just pulled up, this is the inflatable kayak playlist. So a year ago, I started playing around with this Star Rival fish. And I've figured out how to get our ultralight on there, and it goes 6.8 mile an hour. It scoots along pretty good with a 31 pound haul. And I've done all manner of different fisheries with that. I've had it up in New England catching striped bass. I've had it in the Gulf of Mexico catching redfish and speckled trout. I've had it in the Flint River in Georgia catching shoal bass, and I've had it obviously close to home in our tidal largemouth fisheries and my Susquehanna River smallmouth fishery. I've had it in a lot of different places. And what's been unique about that particular boat is that it's the one I'm loading up with me to do all the filming in South Carolina. It's super lightweight. It's shallow draft is probably the biggest thing. I'm gonna pull up the video, the promo video I helped Trey with Innovative Sportsman show off his. But the shallow draft is probably the biggest thing. It goes, you know, most rotomolded kayaks need between 6 and 9 inches of water. Once you get all your gear in there and you're in it, you bottom out around, you know, between 6 and 9 inches. And I actually did a survey on a Facebook page called Kayak Fishing Surveys, where I asked people, please go out to your garage, take a yardstick or whatever measuring device you have, and put it on the ground and measure how many inches is the mud line, you know. And I got that range between 5 and 9.5, I think was the range. But most kayaks need, you know, call it 7, 7.5 inches of water to go in. Right. The inflatables need less than 3. Most of them about 2.5, even with all the gear on it. The amount of freedom that gives you in certain fisheries to pass through there and not run aground, not to go boom and have that plastic hull hit rocks and spook fish everywhere. The stealth is another part of it. You know, it hits rocks and it's basically silent, whereas a roto-molded plastic hull reverberates this big booming sound across the whole pool, and you're not catching those fish. So you have stealth, shallow draft, lightweight package, and you have this unmatched stability. You know, the stability of the physics of it are such that when you have compressed gas in three chambers that you're standing on, the primary stability of it does not want to go underwater. It's why they use them to manufacture stand-up paddle boards, is because standing up, you need a lot of primary stability. And these inflatable kayaks have that amazing next level stability. And I've enjoyed that with the Star Rival fish. The hurdle, though, the tough part was, you know, how are you rigging all the stuff that you want to do that you're usually putting on your plastic boat? You know, I want to put rod holders on there. I want to put an anchor wizard on there. I want to put a torpedo motor on there. I want to put a depth finder on there. I want to do all of these things that we're usually just drilling holes in plastic and turning screws and putting things on there. Well, you can't drill holes in an inflatable. So right. How do you rig it up? In this first video at the bottom here, the Star Rival fish installing the Ultralight 1103 on an inflatable kayak. That was, I mean, it's, what's that, an hour and 11 minutes. It is a video documentation of me learning as I go how to glue on these things called Yak Attack switch pads that I put the track across, you know, in a bridge formation between the two, that I can get my torpedo throttle on there or whatever else. I didn't really, you know, have a guide. I was just trying to figure it out as I went. And throughout that process, I've worked with one of my torpedo dealers that he's local to me, and he's a welder. It's Trey Leach, and he owns Innovative Sportsman, and he makes all sorts of adapter plates and other rock guards and other things that make the Torpedo Ultralight even better or able to be rigged on a boat. He sells the foot control steering kits on it. And yeah, he saw what I was doing, and he's like, can you help me design one? And he's coming out with one this spring that it's going to come standard with at least 8 feet of track on either side in a way to rig whatever you want on it. So you don't have to do everything that I did in this first video where I'm gluing pads on and trying to figure things out. If we go up to, this was the prototype number 5 that I did with them. Can we just watch a little bit of that?
That video was so cool. One thing I want to see on there is, when he goes over that log that's kind of half submerged,
yeah,
he just kind of bumps over that log, and then the rock guard on the torpedo, you know, does exactly what it's supposed to do. That torpedo just pops up, and he keeps on going.
Let's watch a little bit of it, and then we'll come back and talk about, you know, what we're looking at here. Hopefully, I can bypass the I am a small business owner. The ads after 5 seconds. All right, next is the video. So that's part way into it. I'm gonna back it up. Here we go. He's got a chainsaw in the back of there. That orange thing sticking out of the back is a scabbard on a chainsaw.
Oh, yeah. Man, that's a sick looking rig.
So we're out here testing the 5th prototype of the 6 from Innovative Sports Boat. It's a three-chambered inflatable, and very shallow draft. It's semi-lightweight for a 14-foot kayak. It is light. It's got track from bow to stern, so it's fully riggable. And, you know, we're just trying to create a platform that can get you to those hard-to-reach spots, easy to pull over log jams, hard to get to water is the main thing. We can get in there and fish spots that don't get pressured. So we're out here testing today, and this looks like it might be the one.
You're just dragging that right on the ground.
Yeah, I'm going to mute it so maybe we can keep watching whatever's going on, and we'll talk a little bit about it. So when you have an inflatable, and yeah, that one's got double thickness on the bottom of the, you know, those outer tubes, because that's something I've learned with the with the Star Rival fish, is those sidewalls should be thicker and reinforced. And everyone that watches, you know, the season inflatable, they think pool toy, and they think, oh my God, you're going to go fishing with that. As soon as a treble hook from a crankbait hits that, I think it's going to go pew, and you're going to be done. You're going to go, you're going down. No, I've had inflatables for years in the form of a cataract that we, you know, we would float the Susquehanna River with my boys, and just, you know, we would camp on the islands out there. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a jerk bait where I've set the hook on a leaf instead of a fish, and it's come shooting at you and bounced off of this inflatable material. It's tough. It really is tough. It's a lot tougher than you would think, but it is not indestructible. So it's having an inflatable is sort of like mountain biking. If you mountain bike and you go out into some single track somewhere out in the, you know, back country, and just, you know, you bring with you the provisions to fix a flat tire. You bring a patch kit, you bring a little hand pump that's on the, you know, you keep on the frame of your bike so that you can do that. And that's something you need to do when you have an inflatable. All those advantages of shallow draft, super stable, lightweight, stealth, all of those are worth doing. But the trade-off, and that black bag you see there, let's see if he's going to pull this out. I can't remember whether he actually shows the little hand pump. You got to get the NRS actually sells it. It's called the K-Pump Mini. And I have a video I've just released recently that shows how to use the stuff called Tear Aid Type B. And I had a video this winter where I threw my inflatable over the a guardrail, and it hit part of an I-beam, and it did go all at once, you know, and my day wasn't over. It took me 10 minutes with the Terry Type B, and I put a temporary patch on it, and I fished the rest of the day, and it was awesome. And then I got home and did the more permanent patch. But you got to have the K-Pump Mini and the Terry Type B, and you got to learn how to fix a flat. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen, and you don't want it to end your day of fishing. And the longest I've had it take me was 20 minutes. And that's when, of all people, Mike Iaconelli ran his Torquedo motor, like the one we're looking at, into the side wall of the inflatable, and it popped one of the three chambers. So even if you pump one, even if you pop one chamber, you still have three that are keeping you afloat. And Mike did it by accident. He like bumped the throttle. It was his first time using the Torquedo, and it jumped up out of the water in reverse and slammed into the side of my boat. And I had all those tools ready, and he was like, oh my God, did I do that? You know, I'm like, yeah, don't, you know, he still apologized. I'm like, dude, you're that mishap is giving me the opportunity to learn how to do this stuff. And it is so, nice having all those other, you know, the shallow draft and lightweight. I mean, you saw how we're just, we are dragging it around. There's the K-Pump Mini. Know, and you just, you do the temporary patch and pump it back up and keep going. So,
I mean, I'm watching this and, you know, coming from somebody that kind of grew up hanging out on the river and going through situations like this, there's so much value because I just imagine dragging my Big Water 132 through some of these spots over some of these logs, you know, and man, that just sounds like a massive amount of work. Alone from beating up the kayak, you know, the plastic, it's gonna scratch, it's gonna gouge. It's not like it's gonna bounce off, and like you said, you're gonna scare fish along the way. But just like anything else, man, there's a give and take. You know, you need something that's light and something that's float. I mean, it's not indestructible, but it's quick to patch. Just like my dry suit, you know, the first trip, it was actually the third trip out in my dry suit years ago. I got out of the kayak, and now I put all my lures away before I get out of the kayak. But I got back to shore, I got out of the kayak, I walked by it, and my lure snagged my dry suit and went right through it. It's like, oh, well, that sucks. You know, fortunately, the, what is that, Aqua Seal? The Aqua Seal, so...
The Aqua Seal is the permanent patch.
Yeah.
But I mentioned Terry type B for these inflatable. If you carry Terry type A, that's for your dry suit. I actually have some on my NRS dry suit on the sleeve. There's a little cuff. There's like the gasket, and then there's like a neoprene cuff that goes over it, and then there's the rest of it. And I had from putting it on and taking it off, I had a little bit of a tear between the outer layer and the cuff, and it wasn't totally opening up so like water would get in, but I could see the stitching starting to go. And I just, you know, this was back in end of October. I saw it happening, and I slapped some of that Terry type A onto the dry suit right on that seam, and it's, you know, you'll see it when I come up. It's, yeah. It's patched. It's fine.
Yeah. It'll get you through till the end of the season when you got time to send it in.
Yep.
You know, the worst thing to do is send in your dry suit right at the beginning of cold water season.
Right.
Cause yeah, you know, what's going to happen like May, they're sending it back.
Yeah. You want to get that rehabbed in like June.
Yeah.
When they're not busy.
Yeah, that's cool.
So yeah, we're just dragging it over stuff, and it's, you know, it's tough. You know, I you can see the frame in this, and he has those cross members. I think he's going to change how he's mounting the motor on there. But you know, you see the switch pad on the bottom right. That's the key to everything. That black patch that has the track frame attached to it. And again, this was his fifth prototype. And here, let's kick over to this one. He actually I clicked on the speed and range one. And we'll get past this. He let me borrow it for a while and just get the speed and range data. And I did that on a local lake up here in Pennsylvania, and over near Gettysburg, really, and got all the speed and range. And I think this one, and it's not the final one, but it's there. I'm kind of kneeling down on it to test the scuppers, how it drains water out of there. Mm-hmm. There's these little holes that you can kind of see that there's like six holes on one side and six on the other, and it just sucks the water down through and kind of shoots it out of the back. Anyhow, it's, you know, I think he's awaiting the first, you know, and there is nowhere here domestically where you can have these manufactured, the drop stitch flooring. It's all either Vietnam or China. and he's having the hulls themselves. It's the only place that they are manufactured, made overseas. And then he's building the frames out here, adding the seat, adding, you know, all of the different components that you need to in kit forms, whether you want to put the Torquedo on there or you want to put the, you know, a depth finder kit or foot control steering kit, all of that is going to be sort of modular where you can order whatever you want. And I think what he's ended up doing is licensing the top loading track from Yak Attack, where I think there's like a whatever he pays per foot to be able to use their patent in, you know, to have that top loading track, because it is a very good track. So
yeah, Yak Attack makes some really nice products, just bike accessories, also boat accessories, motorcycle accessories, all kinds of stuff.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of Yak Attack stuff on there for sure.
Yeah, you see mine. Probably got enough Yak Attack gear on there to sink it. How is that thing to paddle?
So it's almost a 14-foot boat, but it turns like an 11-footer because that's what people ought to kind of understand, that you're getting extra stability, but you're also getting extra maneuverability, which are usually play opposite one another, and you're getting extra speed. You know, I think people are going to look at this and compare it to what they know, which is roto-molded boats, but they're different. They're different in many different ways. And because it sits on top of the water instead of down in it, you know, because you have a 2.5-inch draft instead of a 7.5-inch draft, turning it is really easy. One of the first times I had mine on the on moving water is I crossed an eddy line and I pushed hard, because as soon as you cross an eddy line with your, you know, with a plastic boat, that current catches all that 7.5 inches of plastic down in the water and pushes your nose downstream. Well, I actually advanced up through a class 1 rapid, not meaning to. Like, I started to, like, I was expecting, all right, it's going to push and I have to do a sweep on the downstream side. And I pushed halfway up through a rapid. I'm like, I'm advancing upstream. How is this happening? You know, because it's so easy to move a boat that sits on top of the water.
Right.
I will tell you, if there is a downside to these boats, is that they are subjected to the wind quite a bit more than a roto-molded boat. It's a trade-off. You get blown around in the wind more just sitting still than you would with a roto-molded boat, because a roto-molded boat is sitting down deeper in it. That being said, you see I have an anchor off the front of that. It requires very little effort with the paddle, with the motor, with an anchor, with the power pole to keep you in place. It doesn't need a whole lot to hold you in place because of the wind. So it's a trade-off that's very easily overcome, if you will, because it's, you know, it sits on top of the water. It's not difficult to hold it in place. But if you do nothing, yeah, the wind will push you around in it. You just need to rig the boat. And I know that one of the key things, you can see the anchor on the front of that, is that it has what it needs to have that, that anchor, you know, up front, an attachment point, so that you can, you know, you can really drop an anchor, the anchor wizard, or however you want to rig it. And it's going to hold in position nicely. So,
right. You know, I really can't wait to see it in person. Man, I think the Steelhead guys are just going to love this thing.
Well, I would think the stealth part of it alone is the stealth in the shallow draft is going to be huge.
Yeah. I mean, you fished a lot of the lower rivers with me, like the Grand and Rocky. But once you start going up, I mean, there's spots where it gets really, really shallow. And a lot of guys, they use the big float boats to come down. And I look at this, and this is a perfect opportunity if you're a guide, if you're just wanting to get out and do some scouting. You don't have to bring your big rig. You just grab this thing, drag it down to the water, go scout for your next trip. Or if you just want to, you know, get out with a buddy, you can each have your own boat, or get out by yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun platform to, you know, to go exploring and going in areas that other people, I don't want to say you can't go, but you struggle more, you know, it's just, everything is easier with this. So,
oh yeah. What's it weigh? Did you say
that? So I know that the Star Rival fish was a 31 pound hull. That wasn't seat weight or anything else. And it certainly wasn't the weight that had all of the track and the switch pads and everything that I put on there to rig it out. This one, and this was just a prototype that he weighed with his deer scale. And I think he had it at 85 pounds with the seat, with the torpedo bracket and all, and the anchor wizard, but not the anchor itself. You know, he had already put a lot of stuff on there, and it was right around 85 pounds. It's the fifth prototype, and he's waiting on the first batch. And I think he's starting slow in just ordering 20 and selling those, and then going from there, you know, he'll order more as he can afford to do it. He's not doing like the crowdfund or the, I forget what are the other ones where you get people to
Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. He's not doing any of that. He's just financing it with what he's got, and it'll grow it from there. One thing I think he's doing standard is the kayak cushion, which is nice. Like every kayak should have a kayak cushion.
Yeah, I need to add one to mine for sure.
Yeah, they're nice. I think he decided I want people to be comfortable, and that thing makes such a big difference.
So this is the one that you're going to have at the boat show, right?
It's either going to be this prototype or one from his first batch. I'm not really sure. It may come down to the timing of when he gets them in. You know, obviously supply chain is, you know, driving all sorts of business happening or not, but it's, you know, I'll for sure have this one, and I may have one of the first ones that he has set up. So this one's kind of neat. This shows that repair I was talking about. This is me driving down into somewhere into Virginia. And I got it all rigged up. I mean, I got all the gear on there ready to drag it, you know, down to the water. What I don't show here is that I threw it over guardrail and it popped. At this point, the boat that's coming down the hill with me, that's my Star Rival fish. The tube on the other side that you can't see is already popped at that point. And I'm just dragging it out. And then I walk through, you know, what it takes the 10 minutes to put the patch on there. And then I think the next day when I was at home, I did the more permanent patch, and that boat's in the back of my F-150 right now, ready to go to, you know, ready to roll south. That's my boat. And, it's, you know,
it seems like it's pretty easy to drag that thing.
It is. It certainly was that day across the snow. but you know, I'm excited to get into the Osprey though, because and he's got one. He's going to take care of me. He's got one for me that is. I'm excited to use it because I want to put a boat like that through the paces and to see, hey, how often am I actually patching a boat like that? And you know, with the thicker walls, I think the Osprey is going to be a more durable one, but it's going to be a little bit heavier than this star rival fish that I've been in for a year. You can see on the back of that seat, did you see that banana shaped orange? Did you see that saw? It was very brief that it was on there. I either carry an electric chainsaw or I carry that handsaw. And sometimes I carry both because we go to a lot of places. There's the saw where there's trees all the way across. And you, in the playlist that I started for that really features that kind of water, which is where I fished with Trey, is called Water Trailblazing. And to be able to get to a log that's all the way across, remove it and keep going is it gets you to water that other people don't fish. And when you're fishing for unpressured fish, fishing is so much better. So much better. They're stupid, uneducated fish that eat everything you put in front of them. It's amazing how different it is when you get to water that other people don't fish. And that saw is part of that whole system. All right, here's the hole. You can see it's deflated.
Oh yeah.
And there's the hole. That was an I-beam from a guardrail.
That's and a big hole.
I had two trucks coming at me from opposite directions in a big old snowbank embankment, and I had to get this kayak tossed over the guardrail and at least partway down that hill, like now. And that's, the rush of doing that. There's the Terraid Type B I was talking about, led me to need to do this temporary patch. And it was truly 10 minutes and I was on my way, and I got to enjoy the rest of that day. And I actually filmed the two different videos, the going mental one, and then the why fish in winter. And I filmed part of a video that is, I think it's scheduled to release in March. If you guys subscribe, if you guys could subscribe to the channel, I'd appreciate it. It helps my metrics and keeps me in SD cards and cameras when I kill them. I kill probably two cameras a year. But hit the notification bell so that when I have new content that comes out, that you get that notification, you watch it. But one of the videos that I shot here, I just shot the underwater footage of an A-rig that I put weights on to really troll it and have it drag along the bottom with a jackhammer attached. I know I just said a whole lot, and this is just one of those tinkering experimentation type things that I do that's part of tackle crafting. There's the K-pump. I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if trolling an A-rig with weights that keep it dragging along the bottom is really going to be a successful thing that works. And I have some little tackle tweaks with that, is in a video that's coming March 1st. And I've scheduled it out through March because I'm doing so much traveling that I need to have a constant flow of content on the channel to keep people's attention, keep the channel growing. Anyhow, that's the patch. It looks awful, but it held and it got me through the day. You can see another little patch with the aqua seal above it to the right.
Yep.
That little circle. And then another bigger patch. But 10 minutes and then it's holding there, and I got through the rest of the day. And
you were able to keep fishing.
Huh?
And you were able to continue to fish.
Yep.
The day.
Yeah. So I will tell you, if you, and I've done this with rotomolded boats and had had holes in rotomolded boats, and that really does end your day.
Yeah.
Because there's no fixing it out there. And I've actually thought of this in terms of you're getting offshore with it. And it's a little scary to think, Harriet, if we're going 4 miles out, well, you still have two chambers to get you home. Like if you pop one, you're going to get home.
Did I ever share that story with you about, what was this? I don't know, 2017, maybe.
Did you take on water out there?
I didn't, but one of my buddies did.
So do you carry a hand pump to build water out?
I do have a hand pump in my hall. And I also add pool noodles in there. And what the pool noodles does is it takes away some of the space for the water to fill, but it also kind of helps keep it afloat if you do take on water.
Right. Hey, I want to address this. See how it's bubbling, which says, "Ooh, your patch didn't work."
Oh yeah.
It was bubbling like that. Very, and it looks like a lot coming out, but that had been like 2 hours into my fishing, and I added a little bit more air and was good the rest of the day. I don't, you know, it wasn't a perfect patch job. It's kind of ugly, but it worked and it got me through. So right. If you watch this video, understand that's what I'm showing there is, you know, some hours had gone by and I needed to just add a little bit more, but it didn't stop me. Anyhow, back to your,
yeah,
your so buddy taking on water.
You know, we're out there pretty far. And my one buddy, Mark, I forget what kind of kayak he was in, but you know, it doesn't matter. They all crack. Doesn't matter which model or brand you buy. They all have potential. It's just one of the things that you got to look at, you know, do a pre-trip before you go out on big water, make sure that you didn't develop a crack along the way or a stress, you know, stress fracture or something like that. So we're out there fishing and it was a little choppy that day. So, you know, there's a little bit of water coming over the deck and right where his seat sits, there's like a drain channel right there. Well, he had developed a crack right in that drain channel. And after 3 hours, his boat was half full of water and it threw him off, you know, obviously becomes unstable when you start getting water in the hole and it threw him off. So, he made a phone call to my one buddy, which was actually the furthest guy out, and told him what happened, you know. So he calls me, John calls me, and he's like, "Hey, Mark's in the water." And I kind of chuckle because Mark's he's a police officer. So every time we fish, he tests, you know, he goes swimming, practices reentry, and all his techniques, you know, every time he goes out. So, you know, I was just like, that's Mark, you know? You know, obviously I stopped laughing because I realized that
he's actually in the water. It actually didn't mean threw to be him there. Off.
And at that point, you know, I'm looking around and I'm like, where exactly is Mark? You know, we didn't have the standard Horizon HX 890s yet. So I didn't really know where he was. We were pretty far apart. There was a group of four of us out there. And so I'm like looking around on Lake Erie. I mean, just surrounded by, you know, 2 miles of water everywhere. And you're trying to find a kayak that, you know, the person that was on it is in the water now. And it's kind of a scary situation to be in. But it taught me a ton just from that situation. So I called my other buddy, Jason, and I'm like, "Hey, Mark's in the water." And he was close enough that he's seen Mark. He's like, "Hey, I think I see him." Well, I seen Jason. So I followed Jason. Jason, you know, made a beeline over towards Mark. And I was still in the Pungo, you know, paddling. These guys were in, Mark's kayak was a paddle kayak, but the other guys were in pedal drives. So we get to Mark. And at that point, I mean, it's looking pretty low in the water. We're still probably, I don't know, mile and a half offshore. And Mark's just, you know, holding on to his kayak, holding on to the kayak in the front. And we're just kind of towing him in. And it got to the point where we felt like the kayak was actually going to sink. I don't know if it would have or not, but it was getting pretty low and, you know, there's electronics on there and fish finder. I mean, that, you know, the electronics and the tackle and all that, you don't want to lose all that stuff, you know?
No.
So we, instead of heading out back towards where we launched, we just headed towards the closest shoreline. And, where we were fishing off of the point, it's all nice, beautiful houses along there and all private shoreline mostly. So we ended up actually having to just pull up on somebody's beach and drain the kayak. You know what I mean? It's one of those situations where it's like, you're not trying to trespass on anybody's property, but like, this is an emergency situation where, you know, we got to get the water out. And when we pulled up, I looked at Mark, I'm like, hey, at least if they call the police on us, we already got one. Right. Just to kind of break the ice. Cause he was kind of flustered a little bit, and, you know, it definitely made a little bit of an impact on him, but it taught me a massive, I didn't realize that was a danger until it happened, you know, and just being in that situation, you prepare so much more, intently. So like when my clients come out, one of the things that I like to do is just check out their kayak. You know, I've seen guys where the Hobie through hole cover is gone. There's just a half inch hole in the kayak. And I'm like, if it kicks up and we're in a foot, you're going to start taking on some water, and then we're in a dangerous situation. And that's with any kayak. Again, it's not brand specific or anything like that. They are still plastic boats. So plastic does have its limitations in that aspect. But the pool noodles in the hall and just doing a quick inspection before you go out. And don't use a scupper cart. You know, I've seen the Hobies crack too. The Hobie does reinforce theirs. But on any other kayak, don't use a scupper cart. That's just going to end badly. And, you know, it's kind of hard to identify the crack in the scupper until you are taking on water.
Yeah, I'm partial to... or you've seen my mega cart that Trey made for me, but landing gear is awesome because you don't have to walk your cart back up to the truck and cable it in or whatever. It's just, you know, Boondocks landing gear, it's a pain to install. Once you have it, you love it.
Yeah.
I asked Trey, I'm like, can you make yours such that that you can get landing gear on the inflatable? I don't know that the inflatable really needs it, but with that, you know, with the Star Rival fish, I actually put an extra layer. I glued with the Aqua Seal an extra layer on the bow so that when I hit stuff, you know, with the rivers, it's more reinforced, but also because I drag it by the, the torpedo mount on its nose, and I don't really care. Like it's you know, it's built up, it's not going anywhere. So I pulled this one up just because this is one of my newer playlists, which is water trailblazing.
This video brought back so many memories from my childhood when we were canoeing down the rivers.
Yeah. Here's the key. You leave the first bank to bank strainer alone. Everyone after that, moving upstream, you remove, then you own it. And I know that sounds selfish, but I'm putting in some serious work in some of these little fisheries, and you know, I kind of want to keep those fish unpressured. You know, you leave the first one there, and yeah, you work every time you go, you drag it over or find a way, you know, to get around it.
There's nothing wrong with that though. You already did most of the work. All you did is, you know, you didn't take out the first obstacle. So if they, you know, if they have the drive and the, you know, enough grit to climb over that first obstacle, they're home free, you know, but if they don't, then they don't deserve them.
But let's going back to the water in the hull of the rotomolded boat. I know one of the guys that's on the that I have a lot of footage, a lot of video from, you know, on the channel is Brandon Barton, who's another kayak fishing guide like you, but he's down in Pensacola, Florida, and he had actually helped Matthew Van, who's another guide in that area, that he was in a kayak fishing tournament and he took on water in his Hobie. I guess he had put the spike for the power pole down in the rod holder and driving down the road, it just kind of pecked at it long enough, like a woodpecker, that it blew out the rod tubes.
Oh.
And every time water would come over, because it got rough out there during this tournament, it was taking on water. The only way, and it was Matthew Van, the only way Matthew got home that day is kind of two things. Well, he got home because, you know, the surf got big. He got home because he had the hand pump in the little hatch, you know, in between his legs, and he was able to get to in between the big breaking waves, open that thing, pump, 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 pump as fast as he can. He said, okay, it's coming. All right, drop this, shut it, and then start pedaling with his legs to get, you know, to get closer. This was before he used the torpedo. Now I think he would have gotten out of there quicker, but he was in trouble. The other thing, though, which is similar to your story, which is a survival story, someone who made it, who may not have, is that that there was communication. There was radio communication. And he got in touch with Brandon and one other buddy, Benton Parrott, and said, look, I'm going down. You guys know where I'm parked? And they were fishing a different point. They're like, yeah, we got out of the water, you know, an hour and a half ago because it got too rough and we're worried about you, and with good reason. They met him in the surf because he was so exhausted. As you know, they met him at the surf break and he jumped out and they just said, just go, you know, we'll get your gear. And they got his gear. And but his boat was totally flooded. And a lot of people would have actually died in that situation. Matthew's tough and has done it a lot. And even his level of experience as a guide wasn't enough it was enough. He got home. But really, his buddies would have, you know, without his buddies, he wouldn't have got any of that gear out of there.
Well, you know, the important thing that I want to point out about this is, you know, you can't stop situations like that from happening, but you can prepare for them. And a lot of times people say, oh, well, I'm in a sit on top kayak, I don't need a hand pump. Well, there's a perfect example where a hand pump, if he didn't have a hand pump, he wouldn't have made it back. You know, no. Since he knew better, since he was prepared for anything, you know, was it a bad situation? Yeah. But, you know, fortunately he was prepared, you know, with the right gear to come out, and I'm sure he learned a ton from it. I mean, those
days. Yeah, he gets to tell that story similar to me telling my hypothermia story, or, you know, when you have failure, there's something gained in failure every time, and lessons learned like that. If you can help other people learn the lesson vicariously by telling the story as much as you can, putting your pride aside and saying, look, my dumbass did this and I almost died.
Right.
You know, if you can do that, it's good. You help people. So,
yeah, you know, there's actually a great podcast episode on that. I brought on Michael Paletta. He had an incident, I think it was 2020. October 2020, where he went out, didn't have the right gear, and he almost didn't make it back. But he comes on the podcast, tells his story. So definitely check out that. That's episode 10.
Okay.
That's an important one to watch. But yeah, man, I'm excited for you to come down, and excited to hang out. I mean, I learn a ton when you come into town, and when we talk and we. So we spend some time together. We can shout ideas and bounce ideas off each other. It's just a great time, you know. And I got
I'm looking forward to it too. It's what I look forward to, and you know, I guided for 10 years, and for 10 years, and I don't want to speak down to anyone, but when you're in a position where you're the expert and you're taking somebody under your wing, you are responsible for them. For their safety. And
absolutely.
it is quite a responsibility, but I enjoy when I get to go with people that I'm going to say I don't have to worry about, but I don't, you know, you can have a little bit more crazy adventures when you know that somebody is experienced and fully capable. And I think you and I are going to do that.
Oh yeah,
we're going to get into some crazy stuff together after the show, and we're going to have some more epic adventures to put up on the little stuff. So for sure, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. Well, you know, if you want to check out that inflatable, the innovative sportsman Osprey 1436, Jeff is bringing it to the Cleveland Boat Show, March 17th through the 20th. Just look for the Lake Erie Kayak Fishing booth. It'll be in there when it's not in the Paddling Discovery Center. So definitely stop up, check it out, see if it fits your needs for your fishery. I know if you spend a lot of time in our upper tributaries, this thing would just be the perfect solution for that.
Right.
So stop by, check it out, stop by, talk with me, talk with Jeff, talk fishing, learn some stuff. I'm going to be giving away some awesome stuff as well. So make sure you enter the giveaways when you stop by, and hope to see everybody there. And Jeff, thanks for coming on, man. I love the channel. Keep up your good work. I have no idea how you consistently put out as much as you do. You're a machine, man. And definitely, a good mentor in the industry.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you having me on today.
Absolutely.
Enjoyed it.
I'll see you soon.
All right. See you, buddy.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the show. Don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast listening app. We will see you on the next episode. And remember, for me, fishing is life.